From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, coming to you from Cleveland, Ohio. This week, Donald Trump, the Republican convention, a fractured party, a defiant Ted Cruz. Last night, Donald Trump accepted the Republican nomination, describing a country, he said, in crisis.
Our convention occurs at a moment of crisis for our nation. The attacks on our police and the terrorism of our cities threaten our very way of life.
Then he promised to fix it and be the voice of the disenchanted.
These are people who work hard but no longer have a voice. I am your voice.
Ted Cruz came with a different agenda, not endorsing Trump.
Vote your conscience. Vote for candidates up and down the ticket who you trust to defend our freedom and to be faithful to the Constitution.
Now the cheers and boos came in. This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with J. Newton Small, Claire Malone, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you share Donald Trump's vision of where we are as a country, of where he can take us? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We are broadcasting today from the studios of WCPN in Cleveland, just a few blocks from the Republican convention wrapped up last night. Cleveland has been a great host city. Joining me here in Cleveland is Jay Newton Small, Washington correspondent for Time Magazine. Jay, thank you very much for being with us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me on, Tom.
Also with us in Cleveland is Claire Malone, senior political writer for 538, regular on the 538 Elections podcast, and a Cleveland native. Claire Malone, great to have you here as well.
It's good to be here.
And from Boston, Jack Beatty joins us. Jack, we've missed you. Hello.
Hello, Tom, Jay, and Claire.
It's great to have everybody right here. Donald Trump stepped to the podium last night and said, "Well, I humbly accept your nomination for the presidency."
Friends, delegates, and fellow Americans, I humbly and gratefully accept your nomination for the presidency of the United States.
And what would he do with that office? He would fix things right off the bat, he said. Here he was.
Beginning on January 20th of 2017, safety will be restored.
To a pretty dark world that he described last night, here he was promising he would take care of it.
The first task for our new administration will be to liberate our citizens from the crime and terrorism and lawlessness that threatens our communities.
J. Newton Small, you were there all week. Claire, you were there all week. It was a fascinating week watching the Republicans work out all the wrinkles and second thoughts and first thoughts and uncertainty about where their party was going. But that was one bravura speech last night. Whatever you think of it, whatever you think of the message, the delivery was on the very, very grand scale. Do you think that Donald Trump pulled together these sort of threads that were all over the place during the week in that speech last night? Did he pull the party together?
It was certainly a speech that everyone that I spoke to, all the delegates that I spoke to leaving, were loved it, thought it was amazing. And it was really meant to bring everybody to the table, right? Because at least two of the four nights, you saw a lot of divisiveness. You saw attempts to undermine him, attempts to say, don't vote for Trump. And I don't know if he fully delivered, and we'll see moving forward if the party is unified or if there's still going to be these, never Trump, stop Trump attempts. But it certainly got the crowd roaring last night. There was so much energy in the room. And it was the first time, honestly, all week, and I've been to, this is my fourth round of presidential mm-hmm. elections, where you really felt it was like a convention, right? I mean, the room was packed and like everybody was roaring and really excited. The other nights, the room wasn't as full. The first two nights, especially, the room was almost half empty. And you didn't have the same kind of energy that you really felt last night, and that was striking to see as a journalist there, just the enthusiasm that he could generate.
How it finally came together on the last night. Claire mm-hmm. Malone, what were they cheering for? As you read that crowd and you heard that message last night, what was that crowd cheering for in Donald Trump's delivery?
I think they were really responding to what I think Trump hired a couple speechwriters who distilled his message down to, I'm going to be a law and order candidate. And there were a lot of lines where, he had a lot of lines about Blue Lives Matter, which is,
The police,
right? A response to Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. I think the crowd was, Trump's big immigration big issue has been immigration, and there were lots of build that wall chants. To me, though, what's interesting is, you know, obviously the convention is, it's a party gathering. The people on the convention floor wanted to be unified, wanted to be convinced, even the people who are Cruz heads way back. And I'm interested to see sort of how the speech will have played on TV. It was 75 minutes long.
Longest in about 40 years, since
1996, Bill Clinton. Wow. Bill Clinton,
I thought I saw 72.
No, he was longer than Bill Clinton. He surpassed it, and someone helpfully tweeted it out. Okay. But, you know, it was a bit of a ramble after a certain point. He kind of looped back in on free trade. It seemed to me a little bit that perhaps the first part of the speech was well-structured, and then they sort of tacked on a lot of, here are some policy points that we want to hit.
It was incredibly dark, the picture he painted of what's going on in this country and the picture he painted abroad, and laid that right around the neck of Barack Obama and especially Hillary Clinton. Here he was talking about war in the Middle East last night.
After 15 years of wars in the Middle East, after trillions of dollars spent and thousands of lives lost, the situation is worse than it has ever been before. This is the legacy of Hillary Clinton. Death, destruction, terrorism, and weakness.
And the crowd goes up in a big cheer. Jack Beatty, I'm sure you were listening there and watching last night along with the rest of the country. This depiction of the United States and of the world is the darkest I can recall, even going all the way back. I was barely old enough to understand. Back to Richard Nixon, the darkest depiction of the world, the country that I can ever remember hearing from that podium on that night, Jack.
I can remember nothing like it. And, you know, Nixon gets a bad rap. That 1968 speech talked about the lift of a driving dream. It talked about Nixon's childhood and Yorba Linda listening to the train whistles and longing to go to the big city. It had American aspiration in it. This speech, well, it was an assault on the ear and an insult to the intelligence. You know, a catalog of magical thinking. We'll defeat ISIS fast. Crime and violence will end. I'll make our country rich again. Huey Long said that a demagogue is a politician who doesn't keep his promises. Well, by that standard, Trump is a super demagogue. And as a demagogue, he appealed, he orchestrated, he whipped up fear. Fear of the crime in the streets, fear of terrorism, fear of economic change, fear of the bands of homicidal immigrants roaming around the land. Fear, and I alone can fix it. The strong man, the leader, America, great again.
Jay Newton Small, he laid a lot of facts out there, a kind of litany of woes, of crime and destruction and terrorism in this country. And clearly, in the last few months, there's been a very steady drumbeat that everyone has noted. When you go back and look step by step, people are going back and fact-checked. And by and large, there's some places where people quibble, but by and large, he had his facts right. Mm-hmm. Was his depiction right of America as a country just kind of coming apart at the seams?
Well, it was really striking to me. All week, you were asking Trump supporters, you know, do you think he has a shot of winning the general election? He's trailing in polls. He's, you know, not doing well nationally. And they all cite Ronald Reagan to you. And they say nobody took Ronald Reagan seriously. Everyone thought he was just an actor from California, that he was stupid, that he was a buffoon. And then all of a sudden, he won this amazing election in 1980. And it's going to be the same with Donald Trump. And yet, tonally, the two could not be more different, right?
In what way?
Well, Ronald Reagan was the happy warrior who didn't criticize his opponents. He only did so when attacked and did so point by point in policy. Donald Trump it just relishes in the attack. You know, I was talking with Kellyanne Conway, who is one of Mike Pence's closest advisors, who was saying to me that she thought that Mike Pence wouldn't spend very much time attacking on the campaign trail, which is the traditional role of the vice president, because Donald Trump does it so effectively and relishes it so much himself. It is striking to see a top of the ticket candidate be so negative in a speech, be so unrelentingly attacking in a speech. It makes you really worry about the campaign for the next 4 months, because it's just, if this is where we're starting point, it's going to be super depressing for the next 4 months of like doom and gloom, and you're horrible and you're even more horrible.
Death, destruction are right on down. Of course, Claire, Ronald Reagan was running ultimately in 1980. And now we're in 2016. Ronald Reagan talked about morning in America.
Right.
Donald Trump didn't say midnight in America, but that's what it sounded like, sort of the, you know, the sun is down and things are dark, dark, dark. Does that sell now? Does that work now?
Well, I think that a lot of people do sense there's a certain, there has been a buildup of violent acts that have, while not, you know, it used to be that leaders were assassinated, right? There was, mm-hmm. you know, you could say this is where the center of power is and this person was killed because of it. And I think that there is a certain sort of creeping dread about terrorist acts nowadays can seem so random. You can walk, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that fear does build in people understandably. And the fact that Trump has played on that fear is canny. It's perhaps, you know, you might judge it immoral. But it started with, you know, back in the first night of the convention when he sort of did, you know, it really was sort of built up over the 4 days, the TikTok of went wrong in Benghazi and how your leaders are lying to you about what's happening. I think that's it's an interesting judgment of perhaps the internet also helps whip up an echo chamber of, yes, it's all worse. It's all worse. And people's news streams, their Facebook feeds are all much more segregated, and I think you can get in an echo chamber very understandably.
He's putting all his chips on that fear, that darkness button that he needs to fix.
Well, and it's striking because the one thing that Donald Trump does incredibly well is understand the sort of psyche and especially the television cycles, right? That's
right.
What he's done.
It's tabloidy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I don't know that the world is any different than it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago, but what is different is everyone has smartphones and they're filming it, right? Mm-hmm. So we are seeing on cable news, all of this like unrest in Turkey, people getting shot. There's always been unrest in Turkey. People have always been getting shot, but we're seeing it now in very graphic doses. And that's what he's harnessing here is the television video aspect of this.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Donald Trump, a divided Republican Party, Trump's big speech last night, Trump's America, and where American presidential politics go from here. We're coming to you from Cleveland, Ohio today, where we've been all week at the Republican National Convention. Claire Malone is with us, senior political writer for 538. J. Newton Small is with us, Washington correspondent for Time Magazine, author of Broad Influence. Jack Beatty is with us as well from Boston, and you can join us. Did Donald Trump speak to you last night? Did he speak for you? Did he describe your America? Does he look to you like the answer to the country's big challenges? And what did you think of the whole week here, of the Republican fissures, of the Ted Cruz primetime payback, of the chance of lock her up, of the Trump family showcase this week in Cleveland? Donald Trump turning his back on a whole lot of traditional Republican orthodoxy last night. First of all, bringing it right home to America. Here's Trump on the deal America would strike with the world, he said, under a President Trump.
Americanism, not globalism, will be our credo. As long as we are led by politicians who will not put America first, then we can be assured that other nations will not treat America with respect, the respect that we deserve.
In the crowd. Really went for it in the hall last night. J. Newton Small, can you describe just what a big change it is to say our credo will be Americanism, not globalism? I mean, for both parties, but for the Republican Party, such a champion of free trade mm-hmm. and an international global order, very much led by the United States ever since World War II, this is enormous.
It was, and it was, I mean, there are a bunch of levels where it was striking last night. I mean, the party platform, which they adopted on the first day of the convention, was almost like thrown out of the room last night. It was sort of, you know, everything that they'd said.
It's still there. It's not gone. But
it's not gone, but it's not what Donald Trump is presenting, mm-hmm. right? The Republicans mm-hmm. have always believed in free trade. The Republicans have always been hawks mm-hmm. Who've believed in interventionism in the world, who have very strongly supported NATO and our allies around the world. And Donald Trump this week in an interview with the New York Times said that he would reevaluate NATO, potentially throw it out, potentially not protect countries if they're attacked in Eastern Europe.
No automatic intervention if a NATO country is attacked, talking about Estonia, the Baltics.
Exactly, which is stunning. And I can tell you a lot of the defense hawks whom I spoke to were freaking out about that. I mean, they were very upset. A lot of the fiscal conservatives that I've spoken to this week were very upset at a lot of his free trade ideas, his ideas of renegotiating our debt with China, which I think he eventually backtracked from. So there, and The social conservatives were very upset last night by his big push for gay marriage, essentially. I mean, he let Peter Thiel speak, who is an openly gay Silicon Valley businessman, and he thanked the crowd for cheering when he talked about equal rights for LGBTQ.
I mean, I don't know about gay marriage, though. He's on the record as opposing gay marriage. He was friendly in broad terms toward the gay community, the LGBTQ community, but...
You're right. You're absolutely right. He's on the record as opposing gay marriage, but he was... in ways that social conservatives were, you know, deeply uncomfortable with. I mean, when Peter Thiel was speaking, there were people behind us in the stands who were yelling,
I
don't know if I can say that on air,
but they could in the hall, but we cannot hear. But he was saying, I'm proud to be gay, to be Republican, to be an American.
Uh-huh.
There was, though, applause overall. At least it sounded, at that point, I was outside the hall, seeing it on TV.
Uh-huh.
It sounded like overall applause for that, which I found remarkable. But you're saying within the hall, nothing like unanimity on that.
It was. I mean, especially when he said these issues, you know, over bathrooms in North Carolina are not important.
Right.
There were people who were yelling, it's important to me, it's important to me. So it was a divided crowd on that point.
I mean, Claire, it's been important to the vice presidential running mate of Donald Trump here, Mike Pence. He's made a lot out of these issues of sexuality.
Sure. Mike Pence is an interesting pick because he's a former Cruz guy. When I was on the floor talking to a lot of people, particularly people from maybe Texas or strongholds of Cruz, they said they almost said it was nice to have Mike Pence being an adult in the room, sort of next to Donald Trump. He's sort of this, he's got the prematurely fully white hair, head of hair, but he's still got that vibrant football coach look, right? So he looks like a Republican vice president.
He looks like a Republican. He's got a very traditional Republican view on gay marriage. So does the platform. I mean, if whatever the tone was from Ivanka Trump last night, very open and welcoming toward this community. Donald Trump, here he was with his when he actually spoke the letters last night and asked for the crowd's approval or thanked them for their approval. Ultimately, here he is talking about the attack in Orlando on the gay disco there, nightclub there, and what he would do to protect the LGBTQ community from ISIS, he said.
As your president, I will do everything in my power to protect our LGBTQ citizens from the violence and oppression of a hateful foreign ideology. Believe me.
I mean, it's a good example here of how what Trump is saying from the stage and what's going on in terms of formal Republican policy can be far apart. He went on to thank them for that applause that you heard there. But if you look at the platform, the Republican platform would overturn the Supreme Court decision to legalize gay marriage in all 50 states. It would make it legal to discriminate against LGBT communities, people. It would discourage gay couples from adopting children. It would make conversion therapy away from homosexuality legal for minors. I mean, Jack Beatty, just take this as an example. But you can go right down the chart here, and Donald Trump seems to have one course, and the Republican Party, at least formally now, and very much, I think, in the bones of many members still, has quite another. It's almost like a new captain has come on board the ship, but the ship's officers are still loyal to many of them to something else. But he's steering.
He's steering the orange ship, I suppose you could say. Didn't you have a delegate come by and say, we're now the orange party? Or
yes, we did.
Yeah, there are these contradictions. Of course, any great party has diversity of opinions, but these are quite striking, and they're incarnated in Mr. Pence, who I think is a very attractive candidate and made, I thought, a winning and appealing speech. But he's a free trader. He voted for the Iraq War. The whole litany of things that are different from Mr. Trump. And he's spoken out, we have to stand with our allies. And so, yes, these contradictions are there. The Democrats will work at them. But I sense that what's going to happen is that Pence and the Republican apparatus is going to move toward Trump. They're going to have to unite now and stop the carping and the backbiting and the terse endorsements, mentioning him once or twice, because the election is now engaged and their whole careers depend on him winning. And I expect we're going to see less of the dissent and less of the ideological dissent from now on.
And Trump, of course, from the podium last night, sort of beyond ideology, saying, promising lots and lots of fixes. I will fix this. I will fix that. We will win on this. We'll win on that. And how will we do it? I will do it, he said. He actually said, I alone can fix it, because he knows the system. Here's Trump last night.
Nobody knows the system better than me. Which is why I alone can fix it.
Jay Newton Small, again, this is something I cannot recall in my experience with presidential candidates. Nobody knows the system better than me. I guess there he's suggesting, look, I've worked the system or used the system or worked through it as a businessman, but I alone can fix it. Wow. Wow.
It was striking. And it's funny because you were there. I went to a breakfast or yesterday morning where there was a bunch of speechwriters giving advice that of the speech he should give. And one of them said he should not use the word I. It should be we. We are having a movement. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We are joining us. And he did not follow that advice at all last night. Everything was I, me, me, me. And it's really interesting because he didn't offer very specific platform or policy ideas, right? It's just sort of he named
almost
all the
none last
none,
night.
Right? He named all the problems and said, "I will fix it," but he doesn't give any solutions. It's almost completely free of any of details and facts and things like that. And it was striking to me there was a report earlier this week where he apparently had offered the vice presidential job to John Kasich, who's the governor of Ohio, who turned him down. And in fact, hardly showed up here this week because he's not a Trump supporter. And they had offered him both domestic and international policy, to which he replied, "Well, what will Donald Trump do?" And they said, apparently, he will make America great again. That's what he's doing. And so he's portraying himself as this man of huge sweeping ideas, of the big picture guy who's just going to fix everything. And that is very much almost an empty suit, right? Like, you can portray into that whatever you want, because he doesn't have a specific, agenda. He doesn't have a specific kind of...
He's a blank canvas a lot of Republicans in the House are actually coming around. Even if you were a Cruz supporter, I was talking to members of the Freedom Caucus a couple weeks ago, and these are people who, a lot of them came in on the Tea Party wave. They were very much against Trump for moral and political reasons. Mm-hmm. And, I sat down with them and a lot of them said, they give the dichotomy of, well, it's a lesser of two evils. But one of them also said, if Trump is in the White House, it's a very simple thing, right? It's the nexus of power basically shifts to Congress and we can push through what we want because Trump is essentially the big picture guy. Mm-hmm. And you can come in and fill in all the spaces there. So while the electorate likes him for his, this, I guess we can call it the strong man, I'm going to fix it. Mm-hmm. I am the single pinpoint of where it'll happen. Republican politicians on the side are saying, he's actually not going to. We can all come in and fill the vacuum. So it's an interesting sort of game the way politicians are thinking about it and the way the electorate is thinking about
it. Jack, does that stand up with the Trump in the White House? I mean, he is a guy who's accustomed to running his own business organization. Of course, I'm sure he's got, plenty of people under him there. But he doesn't sound like someone who wants to just sit in a golden oval office and let Congress do everything. And there's a difference between a blank canvas and an empty suit. There's a lot of drive inside that suit, whether or not he's got specific plans. I mean, try and picture Jack. Okay, now it's January 20th, and he said from that moment, law and order is going to begin returning to this country. Is he really going to sit back and just wait for Congress to mush around on that?
I expect that he's going to do a lot of what President Obama has done and what Republicans have fiercely criticized him for doing, that is, use executive orders and push the powers of the executive to the limit because of his impatience, because of the promises. I'm going to fix it. Well, you can't wait for Congress. You've got to move. And I could imagine a constitutional crisis really with him as president. You've had conservative legal scholars worrying about his essentially collapsing the separation of powers when he was criticizing the federal judge and his views on press freedom and the like, that essentially he's a kind of menace to the constitutional order. And I can imagine him getting into a constitutional impasse with Congress, with his impatience, with his desire to deliver on his impossible promises, and with Congress's balky, slow, deliberate pace.
But I think he's savvy about a large part of the American public, which is impatient with gridlock, with things that just don't seem to be going well enough. And here is a man who says, "I will fix it." Michael in Evansville, Indiana. Michael, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a white male, over 50. I identified with the Republican Party for the majority of my adulthood. I started voting Democratic 8 years ago due to the fiscal policies of the previous administration.
Okay.
I do not intend to support Donald Trump. I intend to vote for Hillary. Not every white male over 50 is going to support this man. He is destroying temporarily what was a very respectable party. I believe that he will lose. I believe that the Republican Party will survive after he's gone in November.
Michael, why do you say he's destroying the party? Why do you say he's destroying it? So, others say the party has grown out of touch, and this is just evidence of that, and he may save it.
He's destroying the reputation temporarily of a party that stood for hope, growth, and opportunity. His brand of demonizing groups of people, demonizing anyone who's against him, is really shameful. And whatever has happened to the Republican electorate this past spring in voting for this man in these primaries is, I believe, temporary. I believe it's just a continuation of an inner battle this party has struggled with for at least 20 years between social conservatives, fiscal conservatives, and then people in general who do not like how America has transpired with...
Yeah, I hear those three paths. It's almost as though Donald Trump is bringing a new path into that formula, the Trump path here. But, Michael, I hear you. You're not on it. One more right here. Newton, Massachusetts. Bill is calling. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom and crew. all my life, for 50 years voting, I've been a liberal Democrat from New York. I live in Massachusetts now. Okay. Quite honestly, I followed Donald Trump's campaign since day one. I believe, and he had no alternative, to use the platform of the Republican Party to get his message to young people, people in their 30s and 40s and 50s. The Republican Party, as it has existed, quite honestly, it doesn't barely exist anymore. These are old white men and old white women. I respect both sexes and give them equal credit. Honestly, no, I don't know any American or any person in my neighborhood or elsewhere where I've traveled the country that is either exclusively right or exclusively left. I am not. I am quite honestly on the fence now. I'm leaning towards Donald Trump. What people he has to say and relate to the general populace in America. And honestly, by polls, regardless of party, most Americans, especially the young, whose country we are leaving to, feel that the whole system, and it is rigged. My God, the Congress is rigged. Even the White House is handcuffed because of that.
And what do you think Donald Trump will do, Bill? What do you think Trump will do?
I think he will target Wall Street. I think he will target the inequity of trade. And I import products from the Orient. Yes, there is a trade inequity. And we literally, and one more thing. If you look around at the executives and the leadership of a good percentage of the country is worldwide.
Yep.
Quite honestly, I don't even think they come up to the standard that we are portraying of Donald Trump. Because they are really, not only are thugs, but they don't deal with us the same way we deal with them. And it has to change.
Bill, our time is short before the break. I appreciate your call very much. I mean, Jay, there is an attitude of receptivity out there in this country. You can see it in the polls already. I don't know how the final vote will turn out. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of people saying things aren't good. They have to change. The parties are mired. This guy can stride in and maybe do it.
He's certainly harnessing the 12% approval rate of Congress right now and the really huge amount of dissatisfaction in the country. That said, in order to unmire Washington, disrupting it more, blowing it up more, I don't know if that's the solution.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, turmoil in Turkey as an attempted coup fails to dislodge Turkish President Erdogan.
Gunshots fired in the streets of Turkey, the crowd ducking for cover. In another part of the country, in a neighborhood where many government offices are located, witnesses say a helicopter dropped a bomb.
a coup that did not work out. On The Late Show with Stephen Colbert Tuesday, Colbert said Melania Trump wanted to address the plagiarism controversy around her convention speech. Here was Laura Benanti as Melania Trump.
I did not plagiarize my speech last night. I would never do such a thing. I would not, could not with a goat.
Okay, sorry, Dr. Seuss. And TV and film legend Gary Marshall died this week, director of Pretty Woman and creator of TV hits like Happy Days, Mork and Mindy, and The Odd Couple.
You never got your name.
Richard Cunningham.
I am Mork from Mork.
We're looking at a week in the news out of Cleveland this week. Donald Trump, a divided Republican Party, Trump's big speech, Trump's America, and where it all goes from here with the J. Newton Small Washington correspondent for Time Magazine, Claire Malone, senior political writer at 538. Jack Beatty is here, and you can join us. Did Donald Trump speak to you last night? Did the party speak to you this week? Can Donald Trump deliver on all those promises last night? And do you see Trump as a path to winning, to breaking the gridlock, to strongman rule? It's a dark speech in many ways last night, though Donald Trump promised a bright future. There was other darkness during the course of the week. This was the most common chant, at least any time I was around the hall of the whole week, about Hillary Clinton and lock her up. Again and again and again, Claire, we heard that in the convention hall. Donald Trump saying last night, he didn't say no, but he just said, let's defeat her in November, trying to turn it a little bit from that. But what about that energy in the hall, that kind of gladiatorial Roman Colosseum energy that seemed so present in the hall last night? And all week.
Yeah. I mean, it was that the moment when Trump said, no, let's defeat her, it was actually sort of a moment of uncharacteristic restraint from him up on a podium. I think that it's a reflection of, some of the callers earlier were talking about how it seems like a different Republican Party. It's very true. We did 538 did some work with SurveyMonkey, which is an online polling group. Mm-hmm. And we found that actually most Republican voters this year are motivated by saying that, one, the issue of immigration, and two, thinking that the country is worse off than it ever has been before. And I think that's, it's a party that, as the rest of the country has become more minority, more educated, the Republican Party has lost college-educated voters, has remained as white as it ever has been, and it's grown a lot more Southern in character. And actually, the interesting, going back to the we want Americanism, not globalism, mm-hmm. one of the things that we found was over the last 10 to 15 years, the counties that show the greatest shift towards being Republican are counties where they identify in the census that ethnically they are American as opposed to, German or mm-hmm. Irish or whatever, mm-hmm. however mm-hmm. you might say that.
Yep.
So there is a sense of reconstituting essentially a white identity, people who feel left behind perhaps. They're older, they're not in industries where you need new skills and technological knowledge. And to a certain extent, they're correct. They are being left behind, and Trump has plucked them out of, out of what he says. He's picking up on the old Nixon line, this giving voice to the silent majority. And
I am your voice.
I am your voice. And it's a savvy line in some ways, but it remains to be seen if it'll work in a general election where you're supposed to sort of reach out to the middle.
The voice before Donald Trump last night, immediately before, was his daughter Ivanka Trump saying last night that her father would be a champion for women and children.
As president, my father will change the labor laws that were put in place at a time when women were not a significant portion of the workforce. And he will focus on making quality childcare affordable and accessible for all.
J. Newton Small, you were listening last night. Ivanka, right before her father, had a lot of things to say on the sort of social welfare front that were very sort of beyond the platform, very open-armed. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, he didn't repeat any of those. But does that mean that those are part of his plan or not? Is that just Ivanka talking?
Well, she is his closest advisor, and she was introducing him. And he did say, wow, what a great speech for her. It was very striking. Her language could have come almost out of a Hillary Clinton speech. Mm-hmm. Talking about equal pay, talking about childcare, and it was, these are issues that Hillary has driven home on the stump the entire election. Hillary's biggest applause line is equal pay, and Ivanka's biggest applause line last night was equal pay. And so it was really striking, her almost feminist message mm-hmm. that is you do not hear at a Republican convention at all. And she said that she, if her father is elected, she would stand there by his side. This would be her agenda, and that he would deliver it.
So she said, but then she's not on the ballot, and he would be if elected president. Jack Beatty, how do you see these these divergent themes, flavors of the Trump package and the more traditional Republican package in Washington, which may not be as diverse as it is across the country at this point, meeting, merging, working together, if indeed it should be Trump in the White House?
Well, you know, I think they agree on what is one of the essentials for Republicans, tax cuts. He boasted of that last night. He said, I had the biggest cut, huge cuts, no one liked me. And, of course, that's exactly the and tax cuts tilted strongly to the wealthy. That's the Republican program. He's also, you know, for going to repeal Dodd-Frank and replace it with something great or glass. Who knows what he's going to do? That's part of the Republican program. He's going to repeal
Dodd-Frank, the banking reform laws.
Yeah, he's going to repeal and replace Obamacare, replace it with, I suppose, something terrific. So, you know, he's really aligned with Paul Ryan's program there, except for the you know, efforts to contain the costs of entitlements. He doesn't seem to have any appetite for that at all, and that seems to be part of his popularity.
Carol in Austin, Texas. Carol, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was just calling in because last night I really felt like I was in part of a Twilight Zone episode. When Mr. Trump was speaking, I really couldn't relate to anything that he was using to describe America today. It's not the place I live. His description was so far off from anything my friends and I and people I talk to see when we walk out the door every day. So I just thought I'd add that to the conversation.
Carol, is that because you're living in an affluent bubble in Austin? I don't know, where everything's fine and dandy. I mean, how do you understand why others would respond so strongly to Donald Trump's appeal?
I've been trying to figure that out for several months because there are members of my extended family who I know think that he really relates to their situation. But I look at it from my point of view and I just don't get it. I really don't, and I keep waiting for someone to explain it to me, but I'm not sure that'll happen.
I appreciate your call, Carol. Jay, is this because people live in different realities? Is this because people watch different media? I mean, how do you explain? I mean, we're going to hear, again, a very big gap between this week and next week, I suppose, in many ways. Maybe not Ivanka Trump's speech, but beyond that. How do you explain how people can look at the world and see it? Some hear Donald Trump describe it, as so dark and say, yeah, that's exactly it. And others say, well, it's got troubles, but, you know, we don't have to throw everything upside down. Why?
There was a great op-ed or a project that the Wall Street Journal did maybe a month ago where they used Facebook and they created an opposite button. So everything in your Facebook feed would, you know, whether you're Republican or Democrat, you could press the button and then you would get the opposite feed.
View of it.
View of it, right? And I think that America needs a lot more of the opposite button just because right now people are so siloed in the news that they want and they kind of don't look at the news that they don't want to look at. Everything is catered to them. The algorithms self-select the news that they would anticipate this person wanting to see, and they don't see the other side of the world. And that's why you get these two incredibly polarized, increasingly polarized groups in America, where you know one group is you know with Democrats and all they see is love and puppies and kittens for Hillary Clinton, and the other group is Republicans and they see love and puppies and kittens for Donald Trump, and they think the other side is evil and the devil. And there's no way, there's no bridging that right now in our society. And there's not a lot of impartial news left where it shows both sides and tries to give you the opinion of the other side.
Of course, Ben Carson this week, Dr. Ben Carson saying Hillary Clinton's sort of essentially inspired by the devil. Another interesting speech up there. Jack Beatty, how do you explain this? I mean, this is not in some ways, though, the old polarization. Maybe Donald Trump is, for some people, the way to break out of the old polarization. He's not your traditional Republican that's been gridlocked with more traditional Democrats for so long. Maybe this people see this as an escape hatch, Jack.
Well, I think that's part of his appeal, that somehow he's going to cut through all this ideological, you know, paralysis. I mean, there's nothing ideological about him. He doesn't go to first principles about anything. Everything is transactional. And so you get a sense that, well, it's sort of like Ross Perot. Remember, he described politics and public policy. You lift up the hood of the car and you tinker with this, you tinker that, you put the hood down, it goes. You eliminate all the values values conflicts, all the ideological conflicts, all the clashes of principle and interest that really make up politics, and you describe it as something you can deal with, in Farrow's case, with a wrench, and with Trump, by what does he say? I'll have some meetings. It'll work.
Of course, we did hear from Mike Pence as well this week, though it got overshadowed in many ways, but he was saying on Wednesday night that the appealing here, not just to Republicans, but all voters, saying that citizens were yearning for a fresh way, a fresh face.
People in both parties are restless for change, ready to break free of old patterns in Washington. And Democrats are about to anoint someone who represents everything this country is tired of. You know, Hillary Clinton wants a better title, and I would, too, if I was already America's Secretary of the Status Quo.
The status quo, which a lot of people are resenting, and look at the popularity of Congress solo. I mean, maybe that is part of what Donald Trump is bringing here. You can say, I'm not this and I'm not that. I don't even go with the Republican platform, even though it's my party's platform. I'm Donald.
Yeah, I mean, Trump is certainly speaking to the fact that people on both sides of the aisle are frustrated by, I don't think they like the idea of sort of, you know, the Clinton dynasty. That's an unattractive thing to a lot of voters. But I will go back to the fact that a lot of, you know, Donald Trump also has a historically high disapproval rating. I mean, both candidates do. Both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are very, very disliked by most Americans. So it's also, while he represents, you know, going against the system, it's also sort of a fraught choice. And, you know, Pence talked about bringing in new people to the party. Well, you know, by 2044, half the country will be minority. The Republicans aren't doing a lot. You know, you can say something in a speech and say we're reaching out, but, you know, Latinos, blacks are not getting the message in everyday news reports that the Republicans are for them. And, you know, in the long run, the party is very much digging themselves into a hole demographically.
Trump last night saying he'd like to bring Sanders supporters into joining his campaign.
I have seen firsthand how the system is rigged against our citizens, just like it was rigged against Bernie Sanders. He never had a chance, never had a chance. But his supporters will join our movement because we will fix his biggest single issue, trade deals that strip our country of its jobs and strip us of our wealth as a country.
And Donald Trump will make the country rich again. He says, Susan in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Susan, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi. After listening to everything last night, I just felt very worried. We could really have a Trump presidency. And I think the only way that Hillary can meet this challenge is if she picks a dynamic VP. And they mentioned, I don't think, have that dynamic to balance against Trump. It's going to have to be either Elizabeth or Bernie.
Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, but we're hearing that may come out today. By the time this airs in your community, we may already know who Hillary Clinton's pick is. I mean, Tim Kaine and Tom Vilsack kind of at the top of the list most recently. Dynamic, next week we'll have a lot of time to talk about Hillary Clinton and what she may, who may be on her ticket. Susan in Milwaukee, I appreciate your call. One more, Buffalo, New York. Larry, thank you for calling. You're on.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to say I'm one of them angry Republicans that agrees with a lot of things that Donald Trump says. I've been mad at things that have been going on for the last 25 years that he's trying to correct.
Do you think he can get it done, Larry? He promises a lot, and I understand, we can hear you're upset about it. Do you think he can get it done?
Well, I hope he gets it done, especially when you go to the store. You're buying things in the store today, either from China, from Taiwan, from Bangladesh, from the Philippines, or from all over. But nothing made in the United States anymore. I know guys that are working here in Western New York. They're sharing Social Security numbers just to get a job because they're illegal aliens. I agree with a lot of things that Trump says. And it's about time somebody woke up and sees the light.
Larry, I appreciate your call from Buffalo. Jack, America first is the mantra, the credo, Donald Trump said last night. How widely does that play? Are Americans really going to be in significant, in majority numbers, saying, yep, that's the way, forget this international stuff, forget these deals, bring it home, do it here?
Well, you know, it's a tarnished slogan. It refers, it was a slogan used by the isolationists and chiefly by Charles Lindbergh in the opposition to intervention in Europe, even to aid to Britain. And, of course, Charles Lindbergh had a medal from Hermann Göring, and there was an anti-Semitic tinge to it. It's in the dustbin of history for a good reason, and he's plucked
it
from there.
Trump says he renews it with a new meaning. He says, that's not what I'm bringing to it. I've got a whole new meaning, and, you know, watch me, hear me now.
Right. But as to his international economic program, it's interesting. The Economist, they had their intelligence unit look at a Trump presidency, and they rank it among the top 10 global risks, right along with jihadi terrorism, for destabilizing the world economy, because the very things that our caller from Buffalo was talking about, the goods from China and so on, he wants to put tariffs on them, and that would create a huge trade war.
Donald Trump counting on enough Americans wanting to destabilize the status quo, not being happy with it as he portrays it.
Well, the problem is that our founding fathers didn't like tyranny, and they made the government a system of checks and balances. So the more you try to blow it up, the more you try to have one branch control the other branches, the more intractable and entrenched it becomes. And so I don't know how you blow that government up and make things change quickly. It just isn't possible.
It would be amazing to see what it looked like with Donald Trump in the White House. His big push for that last night, Jane Newton Small with Time Magazine. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Claire Malone with 538 and the 538 Elections Podcast. Thank you so much, Claire.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, thanks to you, sir.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook from Cleveland. This is On Point.